As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm delighted to be joined today by Jonathan Dog McKenzie. Hi, John.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Well, you're sat next to the talented and virile JJ Bull the Bullard.
Yes,
how are you?
Virile.
You are virile. Now, listen, we were supposed to be joined by Sebastian Stafford Bloor today. The hair doctor, of course, is in Germany and unavailable due to various technical issues. So this episode, a lot more fun than usual. Is that fair? No, bless him. He sat around for 20 minutes waiting for us to sort our shit out. And in the end, we just sent him away again. But listen, he sends his love and he'll be back soon, hopefully. For the time being, though, we will tell you all about what's coming up in the show today. Now, what is in the show today? Arsenal versus Manchester United. Big game. One of the big games of the season. We spend an awful lot of time, too long, in fact, talking about that. That's going to be fun. Chelsea's long contracts. Does that sound interesting to you? No? Well, stop listening before that bit. West Ham and David Moyes. JJ talks about that a little bit later. And, of course, Everton and Frank Lampard. We record this on a Monday. We know nothing. I actually don't know. I'm just saying that because sometimes what happens around February, January, March time is we spend an awful lot of time discussing someone on a Monday recording, and by the time the gosh darn podcast comes out on a Tuesday, that fella's gone! Far more as well. Bit about cows in there, JJ.
You talked a lot about cows.
We did. Cow, regular theme of the show today.
I revealed my true accent.
That's true. You did do that, didn't you? Mm. Yeah. What else happened, John?
We doxed David Moyes.
We doxed David Moyes. That bit was cut out. And, of course, also, you revealed your absolute intense hatred for Casemiro.
Yes.
Remember that
true bit?
Yes.
Yeah. Me and John disagreed.
You did disagree. Oh, that's true.
Think of the conflicts, what you need for good drama.
Imagine that. Imagine that. Now, listen, if you like conflict and good drama, then you should get Paramount Plus. Very good, actually. I've been watching
Top Gun.
I've been watching Yellowstone.
Yeah.
It's quite enjoyable.
Top Gun's so good, though, isn't it? It
does feel weird paying for a streaming service just to watch one show.
Do you know what I watched the other night? It's what? Really good. Yeah. The Dark Knight.
The Batman film.
Yeah, the Christopher Nolan film. So good.
That is, yeah. It's funny, isn't it? It's been so long now that it's okay to say that. If you said that 10 years ago, people would have looked at you like you'd gone insane.
Well, I've seen it before. I hadn't seen it for so long.
Sure.
I remember it differently to how I remember it when it came out ages ago, which must have been when I was at uni, I guess.
Yeah. But it's a bit like in a cultural sense, though, because that's such an accepted comment and starts. It's a bit like saying, oh, the Beatles were good, weren't they?
Oh, I suppose it is one of the top performing like IMDb movies.
I suppose.
So a lot of films I started watching recently and I just stopped after 10 minutes because they're rubbish.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's a shame.
Yeah.
But if you don't want to stop after 10 minutes because something's rubbish, then you should visit The Athletic because nothing is rubbish on there. And I tell you what, if anything, it's bad. My doctor tells me I shouldn't sit on the... He hasn't actually said this to me, but he could say this to me. Don't sit on the toilet, or if you want to, obviously sit on the toilet, but don't sit on the toilet for so long. If you want... Top tip, if you want to, and this is from a friend of mine.
Was Joe panicked when he started the...
No, I didn't panic. I was just trying to...
He started the story.
A friend of mine... Audience, there is discussion of piles upcoming. So if you don't want to hear that, skip ahead a good sort of 4 minutes, maybe. 4 minutes. And if you want to hear it, stay listening for more about piles. It was a friend. I'd tell you if it was me, but a friend of mine had, what do they call it?
No,
piles.
I don't think we need to talk about this in the podcast.
You don't want to talk about piles? No. Why not? What's wrong with talking about piles?
I guess you do like talking about things
that
like
that. Which is a bit of a normal thing that happens to people. It's not ideal.
Particularly men of our age.
Men of our age. But we shouldn't like make piles a scary thing not to discuss, because piles happens to people.
Well, it's more a lot of people want to like listen to a podcast in their commute or while they're having breakfast or something like that.
And that's where they need to hear about piles. Because piles, of course...
Are you doing an ad for piles?
I don't know what's happening. What I'm saying
is... go to piles.com /...
You sit on your toilet for a long...
Customise your piles. This is the point. The doctor said to my friend, after he'd experienced piles, he said, listen, buddy, if you like sitting on the toilet, no big deal, but just finish your business, put the main toilet lid down, sit back down on the top of that. Because the issue is the circle that the toilet lid itself, they literally force it. It's designed to kind of force. So what you're doing is you're just pushing. And if you sit there for a very long time, you can cause those issues for yourself. So if you are someone that spends a long time on the toilet, just finish your business, then put the top lid down, sit on top of that. The reason I say all of this is because The Athletic is so good that I spend longer on the toilet than I should because I'm reading. And sometimes the reads are longer than normal. And the point I'm making is it's a terrific product. And if you visit theathletic.com/TIFO, theathletic.com/TIFO, make an advanced appointment with your doctor.
And to you, listener, this intro is a pretty good gauge of where this podcast goes from now on.
I don't think it's that fun sitting on a toilet with the lid down.
It's not fun.
Isn't the whole point...
Once you're up and... You can't stay in there.
You might as well just sit on a chair. But then isn't the point that people like sitting on a toilet because it's comfortable because of the...
You could put a chair in the bathroom.
No, I think people just
the
alone
experience
time.
Of being like it's suspended above nature.
Well, you're safe.
The door's shut. You're away from everyone else.
It's quite literally intimate as well because you are exposed. You feel... It's a womb-like environment, isn't it? Very womb-like.
No. I just think the gravitational pull is just an enjoyable experience.
Yeah.
That's what people like, you know.
Oh, this is good. Steve Hankey's put this in the plan. NHS Choices website says how you can treat or prevent piles. There's lots of information out there about piles. And you know what? We made a joke. It was a fun bit of time, wasn't it? But piles is a real issue that afflicts many, many people. And people that we know. People that
we talk about
know.
Three games in this podcast.
There's a line in here that says, gently push a pile back inside.
I'm going to... See you later.
Use an ice pack wrapped in a towel to ease discomfort.
It says wipe your bottom with damp toilet paper. Why would that be?
It says damp.
Yeah. I don't think that would be a very nice experience.
Exercise regularly. That's no good. Can't
doesn't
do
say anything about not sitting on the toilet here, though, does it?
You can take paracetamol if piles hurt. Not sure.
Keep your bottom clean and dry. Good advice for all of us.
Okay. So what am I...
Welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. Where else to begin, of course, than with Arsenal 3, 2 Manchester United. Game of the season so far, or at least that's what people said on the Sunday it happened on. And then when the next good one happens, they'll also say the same about that one. But it was a good game, wasn't it, John? It was obviously, there was an element of a title challenge here, although not really, as I heard last night, that is it 538 who do the statistics for most likely to win the league. Manchester United after the game were 1%. I'm so sorry, Steve Hankey, the producer, is derobing in the producer cubicle over there, and young video producer Jamie looks very uncomfortable about that. Sense an HR issue coming up. No, I'm saying Manchester United have a 1% chance of winning the league, same as Newcastle United. I think after this game, obviously, same number of games played, same number of points. Arsenal, 63% chance now of winning the league, which is rather high, isn't it?
it is more than 50%, yeah. Therefore more likely than not.
Yeah. Would you agree that it would be maybe more of a surprise at this point if Arsenal didn't win than if they did?
Well, Arsenal have got, an 8-point advantage if they win their game in hand, is that right?
I think so, yes. And they still have to face Man City twice, but it would be theoretically with an 8-point advantage.
Yeah, and I think the result of that game is obviously going to swing that percentage wildly, because 63%, given they're 8 points clear, isn't actually that much of an advantage. So the model clearly favours Manchester City, depending on what happens in those games.
Why would it favour them, do you think?
Just because if you've got a game against the team that you're challenging in the title against, it's a 6-point swing, and so you still have a good chance of turning the title around. If Manchester City lose one of those two games, then it's much harder for them to actually, because it's just, they've lost 3 points and their opponent have gained 3, so it's a much harder hill to climb. But it's going to be a really interesting second half of the season on that basis, I think, because we can argue till the cows come home about who's better between Arsenal and Man City, but the fact of the matter is we've got halfway through the season and Arsenal have that 8-point advantage.
And do cows leave the field?
Yeah, where is the cow's home?
Where do they go?
I don't know where they go.
They go back to the shed.
Do they go in? Do cows sleep indoors?
Yeah, cow sheds.
They have little sheds.
Should we look this up?
Well, I live in my house in Aberdeenshire.
You can see
all cows in the fields. You can hear them as well.
Do cows sleep in?
They don't have homes.
I've got Meadow near me as well, and they sleep outside.
Yeah, but in winter they will be in a shed.
The most ideal condition for a cow is when the temperature is around 10 degrees. Very few cows like rain. Strong winds or
don't
heat.
They ask them?
This
they
is quite good though. This is the same coming. As me.
You fan of
very
fan
few
of the
cows
rain?
Like rain. They don't like strong winds. They don't like heat. If the weather's too hot or too rainy, a cow will often prefer to stay indoors.
And when it's so cold that you can get ill from being outside, do they still make people sit outside the pub with you? With them?
Yeah, they do.
Only the cows who smoke, though.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. But, listen, that's the rules. That's the rule of part of cow society. If you want to hang out with cool people, you have to sit outside during the wintertime.
Communism.
I think that was true 15 years ago, wasn't it? Now the answer is if you want to hang out with people who smell and hate themselves, you have to sit outside the pub. But anyway, we were talking about Arsenal, who are, JJ, 50 points gained after 19 games. They're on track to be centurions. That doesn't happen very often. I think that's only happened one time before. Are they worth it? They're worth that 50 points, that haul?
Yes, they're really genuinely good.
Yeah. This game showed that, didn't it?
Yeah, and I think the things that would stop them from getting to win the title now are going to be luck going against them.
Meteor strike. Yeah.
Yeah. So meteor strikes, earthquakes, that sort of thing.
If the cows didn't come home.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's going to be if, they don't score, they get an XG of 3.4 and they just don't get the goal. The goalkeeper has had an amazing game or they hit the post or something like that. Just things like that.
Yeah.
Or then maybe just a team sits really deep and manages the block and they don't get the chances and they score. And that's two games in a row where they have that and suddenly you start going, oh my God, but we were so many points clear. And then you start to panic a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think Arteta has the mentality with them going. And I did a video on Tifo IRL that came out on Sunday night. And I think a lot of what makes Arsenal so good is the intensity and energy. So they create a lot of chaos, but there's real controlled moments within it. Players like Odegaard and Zinchenko, who just take the extra beat to try and slow things down in that moment of chaos. So when there's a whirlwind going on around them, they're the ones who are steady on the ball and it helps them create things. But everything's going their way because they are creating these surges at the start of games. So they're 7-0 up, I think, in terms of the first 15 minutes of games.
And that's just so you mean within the first 15 minutes of every game, they've scored 7 goals in those periods of time and their opponents haven't scored.
That's right. That's what I mean to say. Okay. And also, even when they don't score, they just are relentless and go at the team. And it has this effect of then pushing the opposition backwards and making them realise, oh my God, this is a real big thing. And naturally, no matter what they've been told before the game by the manager and whatever they've worked on, they'll naturally fall back a little bit and just try and shore up the defence to make sure that they can't leak anything.
Yeah.
So then you see the first 15 minutes Arsenal have control, this 15 to 30 minutes they have control, and then it starts to be a little bit more, it's a bit more even towards the end of the first half. Then they come out for the second half, and they are strong, and they come out again. And again, they're winning that, I think it's 13-4, I think the score is.
Mm-hmm.
There's a website I got it off the other day, and I can't remember what it's called. So sorry about that, good website, you helped me. And the So that's the thing. So they've got that real energy that comes out. So they're managing games really well, and they finish.
Are they choosing this? They're saying, like, okay, for the first 30 minutes of the first half, we'll press. There'll be a middle period in the second half where maybe things will be more even.
I think it's
we'll
a natural consequence. Strongly,
or it's just natural.
I think that they could do it all the time, they would. But then naturally, you can't do that with the same. It's mostly the same 11 every single week. This is the other thing as well. So if they can keep going like it, like Leicester did when they won the league, and they keep that core unit together and they manage minimal injuries like Jesus just now, then they should be able to get all the way past it, because they've got this... Remember when Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool were really good and you just felt like whoever's playing them knew they're in a battle and it just wasn't going to be fun and you don't want to have to deal with it. It's going to be, oh God, it's not going to be fun. They feel like that just now.
They do.
It's just relentless. But it takes just a little bit of a... like a dent in the tracks to push them off, and it could just see how they come onto that. If it was in, if you're playing Football Manager, it normally comes in February. There's normally a run where just for no reason you start losing, even though it was so easy before. You're just hitting space. Yep. It just changes.
And well, they've Man City coming up pretty soon as well.
They're pretty close. It's in it's in the Champions League week, that. So they put that in.
John, when you listen to JJ talk, I mean, we spend a lot of time talking about tactics and systems and teams as a whole, but it's hard to watch this Arsenal side and not sort of think intensity has a big part to play, right? And that also that the players, they appear to desire it. You know what I'm saying? Do they desire it? They really seem to desire it.
Yeah,
More.
I think what was interesting about the game itself was it almost followed a different trajectory to the trajectory that JJ's describing, which is that they are very controlled in terms of, like, they come out with intensity in the first 15 minutes of both halves usually, but they have had a problem in the season through various games they played there where people have questioned whether or not they've dropped off too much in the second half. And that didn't happen in this game. If anything, the opposite happened, and they were just able to pin Manchester United back for most of the second half after the equalising goal from Manchester United. And I think so much of that has come from the fact that they're able to control games so well that the way that Manchester United wanted to come out against them was by being super aggressive in the first half. They tried to press high, they went player for player in midfield. And this game was actually really interesting if you compare it to the blueprint of the Manchester derby, because Arsenal obviously playing very similar style of football to the way Manchester City are playing. In that Manchester derby, we saw Man United coming out with a flatter back four. And I think the idea was that they were going to try and create space in wide areas and really punish Manchester United by just getting ball progression in the wide areas, because Manchester United operate with a forward press of three players against a back four, which means they're always going to be a man down in that forward press. And so what often can happen is that you can play the ball one side, go back to the goalkeeper, and the goalkeeper can just chip it to the fullback, who's usually free. Man City tried to do that in the first half, but interestingly enough, Manchester United were able to just control the game because they were able to man mark in the middle comfortably when that happened. So what Pep did in the second half was he inverted one of the fullbacks. He brought on Rico Lewis, who is a really exciting young player who is playing as a sort of central midfielder dropping out into the right back area. They went really narrow, and it meant that Manchester United had to narrow their forward press because they have those three players who are going to try and go as player to play where they can. That created space in wide areas, and then we saw Manchester City players in the midfield area dropping into those wide areas. So Kevin De Bruyne moving one way, and I can't remember who they played in central midfield on the other side. It must have been Bernardo Silva. Yeah. And what that did then was that pulled players out from the centre and created more space in the middle. So by being narrower in the lower build-up, created more space further up, and that really caused problems. That was what happened for Arsenal throughout the game. They played that way from the beginning. They had Zinchenko inverting quite a lot, maybe even inverting more in the second half, which Granit Xhaka in particular, moving out into the wide area, pulling his marker with him, and again creating space in there. Manchester United had to be really, really energetic and aggressive to cause Arsenal problems in the first half, and they did do that. But in the second half, I think they couldn't play that way for the whole 90 minutes, and so everything sort of started falling to pieces a bit, and that's why they then started dropping deeper and trying to hold out against Arsenal. But this was a battering by Arsenal, I think, insofar as if you look at the underlying numbers, it's 2.5 XG to 0.3 or something.
Sure.
3-2 is flattering to Manchester United. Yes, they were competitive. They did what they needed to do to stay in the game. But in terms of, if you look at the numbers, it was very much Arsenal deserved to win this game. Mm. And again, like a real show of Arsenal character to come back into the game and then get that win right at the end as well. So yeah, they've got everything at the moment, Arsenal. They have the tactical ability to be able to do these things that we're talking about, but they also have the ability to like keep their heads, which is what they didn't have last season, right?
Yeah.
At the end.
Yeah.
And once you've got that combination of those two things together, you're just unbeatable, really.
And they've got the moral reprehensibility of a terrible, disgusting manager on the sidelines, running up and down and shouting, making noises with his mouth. JJ, something unseen before in football. But of course, the British media, good as they are, have declared that is not allowed.
Well, he is doing things you ought not to do as the manager of a team in England.
I agree.
You should very much wear your suit and stay quiet.
Well, I just sort of feel like you've got a lot more authority when you speak with that voice. Yes,
well, this is actually my real voice, Joe. The whole time in the Scottish thing has been a bravado.
A bravado.
Yes.
Very nice.
That's the word we use in England.
I like it. What do you actually think, though?
In my real voice? Or my fake Scottish one?
I want to hear in your fake Scottish voice what you make. Because obviously, you know, listen, there's a subjective issue here. Do you like a rowdy cowboy? Some do, some don't. Right. I like watching him run up and down, getting those cows. I'm just bringing the cows back from earlier.
It was rowdy, you said.
He's got the rowdy, yeah, not Randy. A rowdy cowboy. Got the lasso. Get those cows, you know what I'm saying?
Maybe
I
his name is Randy, though, because that's an American name, isn't
Randy
it?
The cowboy.
Randy the rowdy cowboy.
Randy the rowdy cowboy. Yeah. My point is more that he's an expressive sort of chap.
Yeah.
I think, I'll tell you shortly, I think it's deliberate. But I'm curious to what, I mean, does it have any impact on you at all? Do you care? Do you feel offended when you watch that it's a problem, that he shouldn't be doing it?
It's annoying in the same way that when Jurgen Klopp does it, it looks performative. They're just trying to get, I agree with you, it's deliberate. I think it's entirely on purpose because the fans see their man. He's trying to create this, not contact, but what's the word?
A siege mentality.
A siege mentality. He's trying to get the fans on side, like, all together with the players as one, so the Emirates is this cauldron of energy and intensity. You
and
don't want to go there.
He talked about energy in the documentary, didn't he?
It works. Like management, like managing a team at the elite level is not just like, the tactics are a big part of it. The player mentality and the role to perform is really important. It's just, there's so many different things, like psychology of the players and just trying to manufacture a team is very difficult with all these individual people who are big egomaniac superstar footballers. It's very hard to do. He's done that. But when you see him on the touchline, I think the fans respond to it because he is like what they are like. Come on, do these things. And energy projects, it definitely comes across. And you see now and again when he gets in trouble, he sort of smirks a bit because you know that he knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
I think he knows entirely what he's doing, but he does it because it comes across and he can't tell anyone he knows what he's doing. He has to keep going with it. And so you see that, and then sure enough, referees will book him and he just runs down the touchline and starts trying to get referees and linesmen to do things that he wants them to do. But Jurgen Klopp's been doing it for years as well. It works for them, and it's the same sort of thing. It's the intensity that really
works. Every winning team has had this in one way or another. Sir Alex Ferguson is famous for, you know, pressing on the referees during games. Jurgen Klopp does it too. Pep Guardiola encourages his players to foul illegal fouls in the game in order to, you know, we call them tactical fouls.
Well, publicly he says he does not do that.
Sure, fine. But like, obviously it's coached because they do it, right? And therefore, that is an example of technically breaking the rules or bending them to find a marginal gain. We all talk about that, like with tactical fouls, like it's a great thing. We talk about how it's like it's really smart and cool. But Pep Guardiola does it in a way where it's sort of very civil and civilized, and he doesn't publicly admit to it, whatever. I don't care. My point is more that because Arteta's thing is very loud and on the sidelines, it draws a lot of attention, draws lots of negative attention from opposite fans because he acts like a fan. But I think it's important because at the beginning of the season, you know, the funniest thing Arsenal have done for me all year is they've managed to make people not like them. I mean, at the beginning of the season, people broadly speaking liked Arsenal. They're a team of lovely young players. Everybody sort of, they all seem like a nice group.
Yeah, and you're happy to play against them.
You're happy to play against them. I enjoy watching them play. I enjoy seeing like the narrative of Arteta sort of come back round again after sticking with him and finally breaking free of the shackles of whatever it is, 18, 19 years of not winning a Premier League trophy. I hope that they win because I think I enjoy them at the beginning of the season. Arteta has created a siege mentality in a team where everyone likes them, apart from Spurs fans. It's like quite an incredible achievement to start sort of going to the lads. Lads, everyone's against you. Everyone's against you. And that works from a psychological perspective. It G's the team up. It makes them feel closer together. It gels them as a unit. And you would argue that there's a marginal gain in their performance as a result of that.
I think he must have looked...
It's an achievement to do that when most people, broadly speaking, don't feel negatively towards you.
Yeah, well, when Arteta's making the step up from being player to assistant, he's done his coaching badges a long time ago. Like he goes from player to assistant under Guardiola to now being the full manager. He will have looked at how other managers have done it and look at what the elite ones have done. Like even like Conte recently creates this real intensity and atmosphere. Jurgen Klopp's done it. He had this intensity and atmosphere.
Yeah.
Alex Ferguson, the way the managers are tends to be how the teams play out on the pitch. Like Guardiola's Man City, they're intricate and they're thoughtful and intelligent, and it eventually just overwhelms people. Mm. It's kind of how Guardiola is. Like on the touchline, he comes across as very methodical, knows what he's doing. Arteta's trying to do what the really great like Liverpool team has done when they're Klopp, where it's all just energy and comes across. But he's got that thoughtful, articulate side because what he's doing is very devious and clever by doing a performative dance on the touchline to get everyone
get
to
a yellow.
Play to his drum.
I'm not saying, for example, that he shouldn't be yellow carded. I think fine. Like you know, the rules are fine to be there, and it's fine for the coaches to press against them. He gets yellow carded, or he gets sent to the stands, or he gets a fine, or whatever. I mean, use it to your advantage, right?
I think it's weird that people start putting like moral distinctions on the fact that they just don't like someone. And the reason you don't like Mikel Arteta is usually because he's an opposition manager who's doing well.
Yeah.
The same's happened with Jurgen Klopp as well. I think people like largely used to like him, but then Liverpool were always winning, and so people are now like, oh, I don't like them.
Yeah.
And that's fine. Like, you don't have to like that. There's a dramatic element to football. You don't have to like everyone. But I always kind of think in this sort of situation, it's like you don't really care about if a manager is in or out of their technical area. You just don't really like him, and so you're trying to externalise that.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to talk about the way that Pep Guardiola has operated recently, because he came out after the 4-2 win against Spurs last week, which we didn't talk about because it was after our podcast.
Yeah, it was on a Thursday night, yeah.
But he obviously came out and then, one, had a lot of things to say about the crowd, but two, had a lot to say about players as well. And again, about the issues of passion and desire and wanting it after being successful for such a long time. And him saying that it's really hard to keep players and teams motivated because
it is
when you're so successful. And what I think
I
so
feel
interesting
that from my own personal experience, I'm so incredibly successful. It's hard.
Yeah.
The hardest thing for me is continuing to wake up every day and just go out there and be more and more successful. It's very hard.
Mm. But I do think with Pep and with Mikel Arteta, I really hate doing calling a manager by the first name like we're pals.
Why did you do it?
Like, because everyone does it, don't
Pep
they?
Guardiola.
I apologise. Guardiola and Mikel Arteta both obviously are developing teams, so they want to control games.
Yeah.
And with Guardiola in particular, I think it's very much about like low risk, de-risking everything, right?
Yeah.
And so it must be super hard to motivate teams to play in a controlled way, if that makes sense. With someone like Jurgen Klopp, he can just scream on the touchline because the whole idea is that you're intense and you run into pressing and stuff. Whereas with Arteta and Guardiola, it's slightly different sense of how do you motivate players, because you don't want them to lose their heads on the field. You want them to do sensible things. But at the same time, it can also be quite a controlled and placid play style. And so I think sometimes like a Klopp team is going to do much better in competition play, partly because it's all about being like, this is the big game.
Yeah.
We prepared for this. We're
going to
be intense. We're going to like run further, run more, run harder, jump into the tackles.
Yeah.
Whereas Pep Guardiola can't do that. He's going to be like, well, we're going to do what we did in all of our other games and we're going to control the game and make sure that we're...
Do you think Pep Guardiola is sort of like the Jeff Bezos of football, you know, in that he's trying to eradicate human error from procedural corporations?
Yeah,
do you think Pep Guardiola, maybe this is very unfair, but if he could replace all of his players
with robots
that were programmed to do exactly what he wanted to do, would he do that, or is there an element of Pep Guardiola that prizes the venture of human creativity and originality? Is that it?
But then maybe ChatGPT can get to that level. So
yeah,
that's true.
It's almost there.
What is art? You know, can you find art in an Amazon smart warehouse?
Probably.
Maybe you can.
This is the thing about City's style of play, though, is that even though they can do everything correctly most of the time, like I was looking at Understats...
They still can't deliver my package the next day.
I was looking at Understats' expected points model, and to find a season in the Premier League when Man City weren't at the top of that model at the end of the season of the points table...
That's
was
true.
Like 2015-16. So basically, according
and
to the underlying numbers...
Was
yeah, that's the season before he arrives. So ever since they've been here, he's put up the best team. But they obviously haven't won it every season.
Just say that again, because that I think like that is an incredible statistic. Every Manchester City season under Pep Guardiola, their XG, their underlying numbers, is better than any other team.
So not the XG, but the expected points. So right. It takes the expected goals for and against, runs it through an algorithm, and works out how many points you would be expected to take from the games that you play.
Yeah.
And in all of those seasons, Manchester City are the top of their expected points tables. Now, that means that you can play basically as close to perfect football as possible and still not win the league, which is why I think Pep Guardiola is so fascinating, because he's playing in a sport where variance is so impactful that you can just do everything right and still not win the league. And so we're all constantly having these arguments about, like, is Pep really that good a manager? Yes, he is. But football is so variable that, like, sometimes
and
it doesn't work out.
Thank God, because if it wasn't, we would have had to stop the podcast a long time ago.
People would have stopped watching the Premier League.
Oh, they would have done. Anyway, listen, speaking of stopping, let's stop now for a short break. And when we return, we'll cover the Manchester United element of that game.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
DirecTV gives you access to apps like Netflix and live sports right next to each other.
I don't get it.
Let me put it in pigeon terms. It's like that one amazing dumpster with the old fruits and cardboard all in one place.
How am I supposed to keep up with illustrative metaphors when you are making me so hungry?
Get live TV and streaming apps together without a satellite. Visit DirecTV.com. Requires high-speed internet-connected Gemini device and separate paid subscription to watch Netflix on DirecTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
Oh, we've returned. What a delightful break that was. In the break there, JJ, you were telling me something interesting about XG. Let's talk about that quickly before we move on to Manchester United.
Well, if you look at Y-Scout's XG, there's lots of different XG models, but if you look at Y-Scout's in particular, Man City are top on XG by quite a distance, 43.6 goals. They've scored 53. That's a big old performance by them. I think that's probably a giant boy-shaped Erling Haaland thing. Then Liverpool should be second on XG.
Liverpool should be second.
Yeah, 38 goals. This is not expected points, so it's very different.
Yeah.
But 38.3 XG, and they scored 34, so that's an underperformance by them. Then Arsenal are third. They've XG of 37.6 and 45 goals. That's a massive overperformance. So if that were to level out, they should score a lot fewer goals. Expected goals against Arsenal, they have the best expected goals against. 16.3.
That means
they're
the best
16. Defensive team.
Defensive team.
Then City, obviously second, but they've conceded 20 goals, which is about 2.3 more than they should have done.
Did you say Arsenal have only conceded 16 goals?
Yeah.
So five of those, nearly a third of them, have been conceded against Manchester United.
Yes.
Wow.
They seem to have their number. Well, and then Newcastle are third next year. It's not expected points, to be clear.
No, that's just goals against. Well, let's talk about Man United. Obviously, John, you already mentioned that you thought this was a walkover to a certain degree. A hammering, I think you described it. It's not a walkover, a hammering. In fact, it very much wasn't a walkover. Manchester United, whether they deserved to or not, did make it rather hard for Arsenal. I think maybe the way of measuring Manchester United's performance here is set against the previous game between the two of them last year and the progress that they've made. Since, of course, we saw the inclusion of Wout Weghorst, who arrived just this month and made some difference. Casemiro was a notable miss from the midfield. So I'm curious to hear from you, based on your expectations of how they would perform, was Casemiro the miss that people said he was, and what kind of difference did Wout Weghorst make?
I don't think Casemiro made much of a difference not being in this game, because I don't feel as though the areas that Arsenal targeted were necessarily areas where Casemiro would have been. The first goal that Arsenal score is from a wide area, they move the ball around, get it to the fullback area, and the ball's crossed in. I don't think Casemiro is going to make any impact there. the second goal was obviously that Saka brilliant finish. You could maybe argue that he that Casemiro would have been
lets Saka pass fairly easily. I think I think they'd moved
Eriksen into that area to offer some sort of cover there as well when Saka was up against Shaw, and I think Shaw passes Saka on there to Eriksen. And
oh, that's what I'm saying. But do you think if Casemiro was in place of Eriksen there, that maybe he blocks that shot?
Yeah, potentially. It's also like a really low value chance as well. Mm-hmm. But then Marcus Rashford's again equally good goal, but very low value chance. And then the only other like notable chance they got was the header from a corner where it was palmed down to Martinez. So again, if you look at a shot map from this game, you can see I think Manchester United had about 6 or 7 shots. Maybe 2 or 3 in the box. Mm-hmm. If you look at the Arsenal chances, I mean, they had 63 touches in the box, Arsenal, so they clearly had the ball in dangerous areas way more. And I think that by the end of the game, the issue is not that Manchester United aren't able to defend in transitional moments, which is what you want someone like Casemiro for, so that they're not able to control the ball well enough outside of the box to do anything other than just sink deeper and deeper into a block, and Arsenal just slowly ground them down. So to me, it didn't really feel like a game where Casemiro would have made a huge amount of difference.
I think it
would have
been a huge difference, like massive. Like even that goal that Saka scores, the one where he comes inside and shoots it, like Eriksen's next to him. So sure enough, maybe Eriksen would still have been there to try and track him a bit too slow. But like McTominay is, I think Casemiro would stand about 2-3 yards forward where Scott McTominay was, sort of predicting where that next bit of play might go. McTominay sort of reacts far too late to stuff, whereas Casemiro might be there, and just his positioning might then have stopped, this is very like hypothetical, but it might then have stopped Saka taking that shot because he would have been in the way. And there's certain things that, like McTominay in build-up is always getting hit, so I think they used Eriksen more as the anticipator blocker kind of guy, like Casemiro is in certain phases, and McTominay was swapping with him, and then they swapped around once they had the ball, and McTominay would go a bit deeper. But Casemiro would be in certain positions that would help them move the ball better, because they didn't want to pass McTominay in closed positions. The Arsenal were trying to, like, I think he was a trigger press, but they weren't using him, so they weren't passing it to him, so they're going wide, and I think that would have been different for how they build up. Also, when McTominay did get the ball high up the pitch, he still did it when he goes sideways and backwards, whereas Casemiro always goes forwards. And just those little things make a difference to the flow of the game.
I think people are maybe running a bit hot on Casemiro because he's come in and they've had that 8-game stretch against fairly naff teams. Yeah. And he's not been under much pressure in possession, and so he's going to look better there. I felt in the City game, it was actually one of his worst performances, but because Manchester United ended up winning that game, everyone was claiming that was the battle won between him and Rodri. Mm. But
everyone, you're really doing an Arteta siege mentality thing.
Everyone
there,
is against me, Joe.
Setting yourself against the world.
Do you not think, though, like, he just reminds me of...
He's better than McTominay. Don't get me wrong. Like, I'm not trying to make this argument. I just don't think that... I think that because Manchester United just couldn't control the game at all,
I don't think the outcome of the game changes if he plays.
No.
Sure. I'm not sure that you would say that either.
No, I don't think... I think Arsenal still have won. I just think the flow of it changes when he's there. Like, there's a reason they win a lot and don't concede. But when him and Varane both play, I think they only conceded like one goal or something. That's something stupid. But there are certain things he does that I think often go unnoticed, not by you per se, but like people...
Certainly by the referees, yeah. there's certainly 3 refereeing decisions again in the Manchester derby where he could have...
Those players are so important. It's like Fernandinho was one who was really good, always in the right place at the right time. And often you don't know he's at the right place at the right time because the ball doesn't go to him. But just by being in a certain position, just quite close to another player or just in where the ball might go next, it makes the opposition have to take a different decision. Because if you look at like an easy pass where you pass it between 2 midfielders and you get the ball up 30 yards and something, you can go in the counter-attack, Casemiro tends to be just slightly enough over to block that pass. It's very hard to say this without putting examples up. I notice it all the time when I watch him. And it stops the player who wants to play that pass from playing it, so they go wide with it instead, which has then changed the shift of that attack. And there is a reason why he wins all these championships. You see, like, Real Madrid are not struggling just now, but they're not quite as cohesive because Tchouaméni is not the same sort of player. But he can fill in all the gaps where these things are, and I think he reads the play so well that when he's not there, you really notice it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with you, but I do think that his upside comes in transitional moments, and I don't really think that Arsenal were causing Manchester United problems in transition. The 2 goals that weren't wonder goals, wasn't a wonder goal, came from just moving the ball into those wide areas and playing sort of across the box. So I don't know. He's obviously a great player and has been important to what Manchester United do, because they didn't have a defensive destroyer, which is what they needed primarily, and he's come in and played the role really well. I just don't think that he would have made too much of a difference.
What is it about him that you hate so much? Don't worry. Tell me about Van Veghorst instead, because whilst he didn't really touch the ball very much, he seemed to make a difference to the team's options.
Yeah, I noticed that in build-up, Manchester United were doing this thing where they were trying to get the ball to him dropping a little bit deeper to create space in behind for particularly Rashford to run onto. Another thing that they were doing in their build-up was they were trying to get... Arsenal were going quite man-oriented as well in the high press. Fernandes was dropping in. We're seeing Luke Shaw inverting actually a little bit and Fernandes trying to pull Partey out of the space in front of Veghorst so that David De Gea could go long to Veghorst. He could either get the flick on or then Manchester United were well positioned to win the second ball. So he's become like he's definitely a very Erik ten Hag kind of player. That's the sort of player that he likes. He's going to pin the opposition back line. He's going to pull players around. He's a good hold-up player as well, and he's also a box presence too. And he's been doing all of those things. I think the goal against Crystal Palace was a really good example of him pulling the back line deeper so that Fernandes had space to run into and then score. I think he scored the goal. Did he score the goal? Maybe they didn't score that goal. I think they did. Maybe they did. Did they?
I actually wasn't listening to you just for that last 1 second. Right. I was reading the next bit of the
I'm sure plan. The audience probably weren't listening either.
Were you listening? Oh, shit. You're in a room
I was
talking
looking for
no
the next
one's
bit
listening
as well.
To you. Well, do you think the audience were listening for that bit?
Will the producer come in for us here?
Steve, do you know, were you listening, Steve?
No.
Oh, man, literally no one was listening to you.
I got the full house.
That's the full house.
I managed to bore everyone in about 30 seconds.
Just that last second there. Well, in which case, let's allow ourselves to read the room and move on from that conversation altogether. We started this podcast by saying that Manchester United have a 1% chance of winning the league. The same as Newcastle, according to 538. JJ, do you think they earned that 1%?
It's 538, all right. Not 538.
Oh, that's how they call it in the cool stats community.
Bruno Fernandes did actually score that
Who
goal.
Who decided it was 538 and not 538, yeah?
Blink-182.
Blink-182. I always used to call them Blink-182.
Yeah. It was 182, though.
No, but, you know, a clever marketing team for Blink-182 would say in the UK, call it absolutely whatever you like. Whatever you like. That's what it is. Just buy the record.
The Cliff Richard thing, isn't it, where he changed his name to Cliff Richard rather than Cliff Richard, so that whenever anyone said Cliff Richards, you could be like, actually, it's Cliff Richard without an S, and it's just...
Did he really start with an S?
No, he didn't. He had a different name entirely.
What was his name? Let's find out.
Ron...
Weasley.
Cliff Weasley. Richards' real name.
It was Ron Weasley.
Cliff Richards' real name, Harry Roger Webb.
Harry Webb, that's it. He changed his name to Cliff Richard because
Harold
of marketing.
Webb.
Yeah, well, Harry... Harry Roger Webb.
What's the name of that referee? Webb?
Howard Webb.
Howard.
Harold Webb.
Do you remember Howard from the Halifax Richardson. Adverts?
Yes.
Or the Netflix adverts, Howard?
Yes.
He was cool. I liked Howard.
Is he not the face of Halifax anymore?
Is he still?
I don't know, I assume so.
Howard from Halifax. Can you explain to overseas listeners who won't know what Halifax is or who Howard
Halifax
from Halifax
is? Halifax is a building society. Presumably originally based in Halifax, which is a northern English town. And they had a face. It was Howard.
Howard Brown is a former customer services representative and sales ambassador for Halifax.
Former.
Owned by the Bank of Scotland.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
Yes, I do.
Yeah? Okay. He's best known for his appearances in Halifax television advertisements, often singing and dancing.
He was in The Office.
Yeah, there you go.
When he's doing the rounds.
That's it. Oh, yeah, here it is. Music and television career. Very long. In 2005, the Bank of Scotland dropped Brown from their versions of the adverts as the style of the adverts was not well received by its customers.
He didn't get cancelled, did he?
In 2005, he released a cover of the Barry White song, You're the First, the Last, My Everything, as a charity single. It peaked at number 13 in the UK singles charts.
Do we have time? I really, really need to see that.
Well, listen, in February 2021... Brown appeared on the TV show Hypothetical in its third season as a special guest. So he's still, Howard Brown's still out there. Well, take care, Howard. We should probably have another break, though. Is it time for a break, Steve?
Yeah.
Well, sounds like you took a break between asking and answering. But let's have a break, and then we'll come back and probably stop talking about Howard Brown.
Hello, I'm Adam Hurry, host of a unique football podcast, one of the top 20 football podcasts in Guatemala, a cult football podcast. No, actually, It's one of the most important football podcasts. Football Clichés, a product of nearly 20 years of obsessive research, is a podcast about the mundane and magical depths of the language of football, the curious and sometimes almost subliminal things that define the way we consume the modern game. At what age is a player eligible to roll back the years? When does a club's highly rated conveyor belt of talent turn into a fabled production line? How many types of goal-scoring header are there in the footballing vocabulary? Football Clichés doesn't just leave no stone unturned. It looks at every single stone and wonders, what's the threshold for a stone to become a rock? But for football, obviously. Listen for your sins on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts.
Yeah, Liverpool 0-0 Chelsea. What a boring game that was, hey? What a boring old game. One of those games where you watch it, you sit at home, and you start by thinking, wow, I wish I was dead. And then you start thinking, if I was dead, though, what would that be like? And then you contemplate life and you think about the meaninglessness and how you don't have any purpose. And
you got married last year, didn't you?
Yeah. I love my wife. Mykhailo Mudryk. I think I might also love this guy. Same hair colour as my wife, but more tattoos. He's sort of looking interesting and sort of looking guy. Looks like a good player of football, JJ Ball, with a purpose.
He's very good.
Yeah.
He's really quick. You saw him a couple of bursts late in the game where he came on and just made things happen. Mm. This is what this guy does. He makes things happen. He's very direct, very explosive, you say.
He explodes.
Yeah, he's two-footed, like completely two-footed. He can go either way. He can cross from his left and his right because he's two-footed.
Yeah.
And he can shoot with his left or his right.
All the things important for a football player. And, you know, the thing that's important for a football team is that they have him signed on an extremely long contract. Chelsea have a few of these now. Almost seems as though they're in vogue, John McKenzie. Big old contracts for Wesley Fofana, Benoit Badiashile as well. 7 or 8 year stretches. Why are they doing this?
Well, Todd Boehly is an American. He owns other sports franchises in America.
Yes.
And having long contracts is a thing that they do in the US.
In America.
It's true.
We learn so much from America, don't we?
We do, yes.
Mm.
They've won the cultural war.
They have done.
If it was Civ, they'd have won that.
They've won it big time, yeah. They've influenced the culture of the rest of the world in a major, major way, major way.
I think people are influenced by friends. I think that just does so much to everyone.
It does.
Of a certain age.
It does. You know, I saw a boy band on TikTok the other day make a video about why they sing in an American accent, because they're a British band, and people ask them about it, and then they sung their song in a British accent, and it did sound stupid.
Well, I remember we used to play in bands, and there was all these skate punk bands we'd play.
Yeah.
And it was when all Blink-182 and that were, you know, big and everything. We all loved that stuff.
Blink-182.
Blink-182.
Yeah.
And there was one, I can't remember what they called, some Glasgow band, and they'd be like, all right, boys, you should go on. I'm going on stage now, all right? And they go on stage and be like, I'm going to the mall on my skateboard. You can't stop me.
Yeah.
All right, Glasgow, thanks very much. They're coming down.
My sister-in-law did her whole master's, her dissertation was about people, singers' choice of accent. It is very interesting. But there are reasons for it. What I'm saying, I suppose, is that we shouldn't discourage people from singing in whatever way brings them joy.
I watched the Burnley game against West Brom on Friday.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't have thought that you could tell where the crowd were from singing.
But you can.
But you could when the Burnley fans song.
That's
the thing I took away.
You can tell Newcastle when they sing as well. You can hear that accent, I think.
I like that. Yeah, just the tone of the boo. Mm, very enjoyable. Very enjoyable. Fine, well, listen, anyway, we're here to discuss the length of Chelsea's contracts. Yes. As I said, Wesley Fofana, Benoit Badiashile, 7 to 8 years. Why so long, America?
Yeah, well, Americans have longer contracts, but there's a different context of transfer.
They have longer lives.
Yeah, that's right. They've actually worked out how long these players are going to live and divided their age by. That's not what happens.
No.
But obviously there's a lot of reasons why you might want to have a longer contract as a club, because
expected life.
Yeah.
John's reached the end of his tether with us interrupting now. We'll let him. No, we'll let him carry on.
Steve Hankey to be a producer and try and rein it in. You've got much worse ever since you did.
Come on, Steve.
Why can't you... deniability right there, isn't it?
It's like, no, I'm actually interested in the answer to this question.
Yeah. Essentially, if you have a young player and you can get them on a long contract, it de-risks a lot of the issues that you can have, both in terms of, so there's two issues, I think. One of them is obviously just actual value. You're worried about the value of your player. But the other one is FFP value as well, so things with amortization as well. As you know, when you bring in a player, you're able to spread the cost of that player through a number of years. The longer that contract is going to be, the more you're able to spread that cost, and so the smaller the book value will actually be. Yeah.
And it means they're worth more money later on. So if you had a player in like a 3-4 year deal, towards the end of that, they might be worth 50 million at the start, then they're worth less because people would see, well, you've got less time in your contract, so you could...
Basically. So when you're buying a player, you're not actually just buying that player. No one owns the player. What you're buying is the right to play that player for a certain amount of time. So Mikhailo Mudryk has been bought for however much it was, 100 million, what, 80 million?
For 7 years, right?
Yeah.
Or eight. Something.
So you've paid 70, 80 million to play that player for those years.
Let's make it simple and say it was 80 million in 8 years, even though it wasn't. That's the amortized value is 10 million a year, right?
So, yeah, everything that you bring in as a business will devalue through time, and that contract is no different, right? The further you go through that contract, it's worth less, but you've also been paying to play the player, so you're getting the value out of it as well. So if you have a long contract, you're able to spread the value over a longer period, and as you go through that, each year you're taking 10 million off that value. So halfway through that contract, Mudryk will be considered to be worth 40 million in terms of their book value, the remaining that Chelsea still have to pay.
The question therefore is, I can understand entirely why a club would want to do that, because it seems that it's completely within their interest. Why would a player at Mudryk's age sign an 8-year contract if you think, for example, okay, 4 years down the line you have a great run of seasons and Real Madrid or Barcelona come in for you, offer you a pay rise, they want to take you on, but your club won't sell because there's 4 years of your contract left?
Just before I get to that, some of the other things that it's better for the club before we get to the player. But like, obviously, when the player's contracted, they can't leave for free, which is obviously the longer that you have, the less time you have to worry about that. And if you think about a player having like a 3 or 4 year contract, as soon as they've gone 1 or 2 years into that 3 or 4 year contract, you're immediately having to think of selling them on because you wanted to get value back for them. If you get to a year before their contract is up, their value is going to be much lower than peak again. So if you have a longer contract, you don't have that issue until much later in their contract as well. You can also keep wages lower. You know what the wage packet is going to be for that player because it will be probably straight line. But there may be situations where you can say, at a certain point, your wage is going to go up or down depending on where you're at in the contract. And even if like a player gets injured, like a lot of people say, well, what if you buy a player on an 8-year contract and they get injured? Clubs do have pretty slick insurance packages as well. So that has been de-risked as well. And again, it's important to remember that this is a sort of linear risk model as well. So like your insurance premium is going to go up, but you know exactly how it's going to go up. It's going to go up in a linear manner. So again, it's going to cost you the same amount as if you bought a player on a shorter contract, etc. So it's just ways for the club to know that they're actually de-risking themselves in terms of this player's career. It's going to be fine for them.
It's important to remember that this is a linear risk model. I'm going to start using that line.
But look, Harry Kane's gone and done himself with that long contract at Spurs.
Well, indeed.
So then that would be the downside of it, right, for the player?
Yeah, for the player, yeah.
Something you can't even do in some countries.
Yes. So there is rules about, I think that
Italy, you can't sign players in Italy.
For FIFA, you're not allowed to offer a contract that's over 5 years unless the laws of the country that you're in allow it.
Allow
in Italy, you can't do that.
Yeah.
That's a workers' rights thing, right? Because as you're saying, once you're in a contract, it's very hard to get out of it unless certain conditions are met as well. So the big question is, why would a player agree to do that? But I think someone of Mudryk's age, he would be, I think when it's a big club like Chelsea, you can be pretty sure that like that's not going to ruin your career unless you do something wrong or something goes wrong for you. I guess the other thing that you might talk about would be, as you were saying before, if you're amortizing a player on a really high wage, they might not, on a really high transfer fee, sorry, they may not want to sell you early on because they'll, as we said, if Mudryk's value is going down by 10 million a year and they paid 80 million for him, after 2 years he'll still have a book value of 60 million to them, and it would be unlikely that, unless he really explodes, that they would make more money than that. So again, that might induce Chelsea to try and keep him on as long and say, once he's got 3 years left on his contract, then he's only book valued at 30 million, and so they would then be able to book a profit if they sold him for more than 30 million. So I think there is definitely like a risk for the player, but I think you know that you're guaranteed to get a decent wage for for 8.5 years.
Mm.
And if you're a young player in particular, I guess there's always the risk that you might not live up to your potential. And so this might be the best contract that he could feasibly get for the rest of his career. And if it isn't, and he does really well, then you would hope that he would be able to be sold on as well. But
yeah,
it's definitely a brave new world of like approaching contracts. And I think clubs are going to try and do that if they can, because obviously they're de-risking those contracts. But the risk is going to be, as always, to the players.
Ah, the shifting tides of the balance of power between players and clubs. A war of attrition that will never end, JJ. Speaking of wars of attrition, West Ham 2, 0 Everton. Now, goodness gracious me, I don't think we should spend that long speaking about this, because this has the feel of a podcast topic of conversation that we record on a Monday, and by a Tuesday, it is no longer relevant. But good for West Ham to get a win.
Yeah. I mean, obviously that's good for them. David Moyes not having the best season, but like, that win takes them... Like, it looks terrible when they're sitting in 19th, wherever they were before the game started, and that just jumps them straight up to 16th. Another win, and everyone else above them loses, and they jump up to 13th, which is fine for West Ham. So it's a weird bit, that bottom and half of the table. It's very easy to kind of get out of them. West Ham struggle to change from being a counter-attack transition team. They want to try and turn into more of a exciting, entertaining, possession-based kind of game. In fact, David Moyes was on a podcast, the Diary of a CEO thing. I listened to that. It's really good.
Oh, was he on that?
Yeah, it was really interesting, talking about what he found at Man United, how he felt let down by them, a few different things, and how he wants to build a new West Ham and the difficulties that come with that. Yeah, it was cool hearing him talk in that way. But you see with West Ham, it takes a while for new players to gel always, and they've had a bit of bad luck with some of the things going on, and...
Do you not have Everton to be a CEO probably. To go on that podcast? Is that not?
Well, apparently not.
I thought it was for CEOs.
I think he's the CEO, the boy Steve Bartlett.
That guy is, yeah.
He owns a few companies.
David Moyes, I suppose, probably is, probably could be. I'm sure he owns some companies.
So like we're talking earlier about Arsenal having that real momentum and intensity, the kind of thing that Liverpool have lost, right? So you see Liverpool have great players who aren't playing well, and they've lost that intensity and momentum and that air of unbeatability that they used to have, and so suddenly they seem quite beatable, and they are beatable, and they're just not playing very well. They're lacking what makes them really, really work, and it'll take a bit of time to get them back on, because you can't just give players confidence. They have to grow it through winning games.
Yeah.
Now Everton, I mean, that went out months ago, completely gone.
Yeah.
There's a great article in The Athletic this morning by what's his name again?
Ahmed Walid.
Yeah, it's so good. If you've got The Athletic, or you don't, you sign up, but if you do, go and read it. It looks at how Everton are even worse when they've conceded, because they just lose all their defensive shape, easily beaten in transition. That's how West Ham did them in this game, and there's loads of examples from throughout the season where they don't look well coached to me. And right. It could be that the players aren't good enough. So, like, sure enough, you have a good coach in there and the players are making mistakes. That's not the manager's fault. That's the players not doing the things they're supposed to do. So it could be that. But I remember watching Lampard's Chelsea and thinking they looked quite good in the final third, because they had good players and it was quite chaotic what you're trying to build. But they had real trouble defensively and they were getting beaten too easily, and they became more of an upper mid-table team. I mean, that's been harsh. I think they were like fourth or something when they got done. But Everton now, they just look really disjointed. He's saying all the right things about how they're going to put the work in, whatever. The players aren't really good enough. They have no budget whatsoever to be able to buy anyone in to make it better. And the players they've had are the same ones they've had for a little while. And they're putting round peg square holes, playing Alex Iwobi as a wing back doesn't work. This is not a good idea. And I don't know how they get that back. The only real way you can try and like reset that is just getting rid of a Lampard and putting someone else in. But it might not be that Lampard is that bad a coach. Like, I mean, it's just the players, like I'm saying. It could be that that's what the case is, and he could easily fix it with different players coming in. But at the moment, it looks like the only way they could do it is you bring in someone who could just arrest that and turn it into a real defensive team, sit in a low block and do that Sam Allardyce classic thing where you just shithouse your way
to... Are you speaking of Sean Dyche?
Well, I don't know if Sean Dyche is actually that kind of... Like, man, what he did really well with Burnley is they were a lot more attacking than you'd think, Burnley. Like, they pushed up really high, line often.
They pressed high in phases as well. People always think of them just being a low block team, but they just had their moments of going forward and then their moments of knowing when to drop back.
And they were fast. It was fast and direct.
Yeah.
The back four became a back three regularly. He was doing that before a lot of other teams were doing it. Like, tactically, it was quite clever, but he forged a mentality that meant they could... They battle. You don't want to play against Burnley. They had big hoofers who would kick you about. And Everton don't really have that. They've got...
Back to the cows again.
Yeah. Well, that's heifers.
Oh, heifers.
Hoofers are like fridge freezers you put up front.
Right.
And yeah, Everton's best player, Calvert-Lewin, always injured. You can't do much with that. The defenders individually aren't playing very well. It's a real struggle to see where they get that without having a...
Is it nothing lost, nothing gained for Everton, isn't it? Sort of like they're going down under Lampard. He's had 38 games in charge, I think, and he's got 35 points, which is less than a point per game, which is not enough to really consistently stay in the top flight. And it's got to a point now, he's taking them down. You might as well just flip things up and see if you can get someone in who's going to change things.
Yeah, his win percentage is 27.9. That's not good. No. Ancelotti, Benitez was in before him, obviously, didn't like him. He was 31, but that was when all the trouble sort of started because they spent all their money on different players and now they're getting rid of them, trying to take the wage budget down.
I mean, presumably part of the issue with the Lampard thing is, obviously, we spoke about this the other week, but the board didn't go to the game the other day and there's sort of, you know, machinations ongoing behind the scenes. It's a difficult time to make that kind of managerial change.
Yeah, I think it's going to be an issue trying to get anyone in. Like,
yeah.
You know, people are saying
it's
Sean
a shit
Dyche
show, right?
As though Sean Dyche is going to just happily... drop
walk
into
this, a shit show.
Yeah. And I don't think that he will. Why would he? He'll be able to pick up any of the teams, I guess, that dropped their manager in the last run of the season.
I mean, also, what's he doing right now, Sean Dyche?
Because Sean Dyche is going around watching football games and probably getting better at
chilling out, getting better.
Yeah. Do you know what I thought might be an idea for Everton is they keep Lampard for the season because maybe turns it around and proves himself to be a really capable, like, quality coach. Maybe he brings another coach to help him get the defence sorted out, something like that, maybe. Maybe they sign players in January, who knows. But also, if they get to the end of the season and they are relegated, which obviously would be bad, then step in Captain Wayne Rooney to come in, who did very well with Derby in the Championship with a real problem club they had, like, constant turnover of players, loads of youth players you had to bring in to turn it into a cohesive, workable team, and they were good. They had to fight. They got relegated because they had that massive points total. They just couldn't get over the line. But I watched Derby last season to do a thing we did on Derby and what was wrong with them. And you think it would be the romantic thing, bringing in a former club legend so the fans can then connect with it. You might get a bit of that. Like a lot of the, again, going back to Arsenal, start of the podcast, the connection between the fans and the players and the manager, it seems all there and that really helps. And it seems that there's a disconnect between like owners, manager, club and fans and all that bit's going on with that club just now. And it's very hard to then settle all that. But you bring in something like Wayne Rooney, unproven, he might be an excellent choice. Who knows?
Who knows? Captain Wayne.
Mm.
Okay, well, Steve's got a couple of notes for me here. Everton due, of course, to be in their new stadium for the 24-25 season. So were they to be relegated this season, they would spend the last year in Goodison Park in the Championship.
That'd be fun. They'd win loads.
You know, I was going to say, could be sad, could be fun, depending on your perspective. I think from a financial perspective, the club being relegated wouldn't be fun.
No.
We've covered that in video form before last year when they were in a similar position, and of course they escaped it then. But much more interestingly, a heifer is a female cow that has not had any offspring yet. The term usually refers to the immature females. After giving birth to her first calf, however, a heifer becomes a cow. And an adult male is known as a bull, of course. But what is a child male known as a bullock? That's right, isn't it? A bullock? A calf, a bullock?
Sandra Bullock and JJ Bull.
Sandra Bullock. Sandra Bull, yes.
And JJ Bullock.
JJ Bullock.
A bullock, young neutered male cattle primarily raised for beef.
Neutered, you say? Well, now. Again, perspective.
Let's hope that JJ never becomes JJ Bullock.
No. Imagine the zest that would be disappear from his character. Do you think that happens? I don't know. I don't speak for people who are without... testicles, but I mean, and eunuchs, did they have personality changes, or was it
what's next in the plan?
The lack of... Well, there we go, it's a conversation about eunuchs. Let's move on. We don't know anything about eunuchs, do we? But JJ Bull, we know a lot about you, and we'll miss you for the rest of the week. All the best, take care.
Where am I going?
I don't know, just, you know, the listeners will miss you, not me. I'll see you.
Oh, you'll see
me. I'm sick and tired of you.
Well, they can see me all the time on YouTube.
That's true. Where can they see you?
Tifo IRL.
That's right. And John McKenzie, they can see you there too.
They can.
Yes. And enjoy the rest of your week.
Thank you.
Oh, you were on the Totally Football podcast as well yesterday, weren't you?
I was.
Yeah, bigger and better
Mr.
things,
Mr. Big
it?
Shot.
Yeah, Big Shot. What did you say on there? Was it as good as us?
I said I don't like you and or any of you, actually.
You said to them you didn't like them?
No, you.
Oh, I was going to say, it's confusing.
I thought he would limp that just to you, but he means me and Seb as well.
You as well.
Yeah. And Jamie.
And Jamie.
And wow. Steve.
Especially Jamie.
So what you're telling me is that you went on the biggest football podcast in the UK and you used it as an opportunity to say that you don't like people the audience have never heard of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically. It seems like you've ruined your chance to go on there again, doesn't it?
Potentially.
Check him out on the Totally Football podcast with James Richardson. Hopefully you'll enjoy that. And if you don't like John, then don't do that. Because he's on it. Yeah. Steve Hankey, thank you very much for joining us today. Good job restraining the conversation.
Yeah, it didn't really work, did it?
No, it didn't work, no. But of course, thank you to your silent partner in crime over there, Jamie the Video Man. Thank you, Jamie. All the best for the rest of the week there. Back from skiing is Jamie. From skiing! We'll be back next week to do this again. Hopefully we'll be joined by Seb Stafford-Bloor when we can fix the internet blockade between Germany and England. But it's all going to be fine for the rest of the season. Take care, all the best, and bienvenue! That's welcome, isn't it? Again, I've said it again. Goodbye!
Athletic.